Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, we throw the spotlight on Haiti as it slowly recovers from January's devastating earthquake. Why it's important that the island nation remains on our radar screen. And up to 50,000 Iraqi refugees in Lebanon find themselves in a legislative limbo with no visas and no rights. Whatever happened to Haiti? With news of environmental disaster off the U.S. coast, the World Cup, and the global economic downturn, the slow recovery from Haiti's disastrous earthquake has disappeared from the media radar screens. Tens of thousands of people were left homeless by the January 12th quake, and reconstruction of the many collapsed or damaged buildings in Port-au-Prince is making slow progress. Well, we asked the Apostolic Nuncio to Haiti, Archbishop Bernardito Auza, how people and the Catholic Church have been affected on the Caribbean nation.
The Catholic Church, being one of the biggest institutions in the country together with the state, also suffered a lot materially because also it has many properties. But it's really the saddest part of it. We have lost the biggest churches and also churches which are cultural patrimony of the country. We have lost the cathedral. We have lost the most ancient churches in the capital. And then we have lost the national seminaries. We have lost lots of schools. Around 90% of Catholic schools in the area were affected in one way or another. In terms of personal, the saddest thing is that we have the Archbishop of Port-au-Prince died, and then the Vicar General, and then the Chancellor, five other priests, and then 14 major seminarians and 56 religious men and women. And then many of our priests and nuns and religious, they are still under very heavy psychological shock because many of them were also under the rubbles during the earthquake. The first days after the earthquake, certainly it was very difficult to have international aid come to the country because the airport was destroyed. No, the tower was the control tower was destroyed, and the only way to bring in international aid was through the Dominican Republic. And unfortunately, the roads are not good, so it was very difficult during the first days, during the first week of the catastrophe, and the people really thought that they were abandoned in a sense because of the few amount of aid coming. But in the next months, I would say in the next 2 or 3 months after the earthquake, certainly the distribution of international aid is much better organized. And the quantity also of the humanitarian aid from the international community has been really big. We could hear less complaints now about the difficulty of getting aid. But of course, given the vastity of the need, with around 2 million people needing assistance, especially the 1,250,000 who have lost their homes, who are living in the streets and in the makeshift camps, the international aid, they always say that it's not enough, but at least the distribution has become more organized and the amount of aid is still very consistent. Unfortunately, the situation is still really in an emergency phase because people are still living in the streets in tents and under tarps, tarpaulins. So those are plastic things that, even with not a very strong wind, they will just be carried away. So it's still really the fundamental priority now is really how to help these people find better shelters, more structured camps. The second is, we are in this transitional phase, which is not yet happening. The transitional camps are not yet built, and there is a need of lots of money just to move more than 1 million people to more structured camps. And for us, for the church above all, our greatest need now is we are starting the process of reconstructing churches, parish houses, schools, religious houses, the seminaries, etc. So in this phase of reconstruction, certainly our biggest need would be financing. So that's we ask all conferences of bishops and all the lay faithful and all men and women of goodwill to help us in this very big task ahead of us.
Archbishop Bernardito Auza, the Apostolic Nuncio to Haiti. Well, I sat down with the World Food Program's Stephen Cahill, who recently returned from an aid mission to Haiti. I asked him whether he sees a danger in Haiti's falling off the radar screens.
Yeah, I think it's always a danger, you know, especially something as catastrophic as happened to Haiti. It needs to be in the media, you know, and it needs to be continually there. I mean, I think people need to be reminded and they need to be focused on it, because I mean, I think also people put a lot of pressure on their governments in order to support places like Haiti, and need support.
Were you there shortly after the quake struck in January?
I was there quite late. What we'd consider quite late was probably just almost 3 months after the earthquake.
But the World Food Program was, I would assume, was pretty quick on the ground there.
We already had a big operation there anyway. Before the earthquake, we had 200 people there. Mm-hmm. It was by far our biggest operation in Central America and the Caribbean. And within 2 weeks, we had augmented that up to 400 people. Mm-hmm. And now it's stable around 400 people.
What are the conditions now on the ground in terms of infrastructure? Is food arriving to the people? How many people are living in camps? How many people were able to fix up their homes and return to them? Give us an idea of what's happening.
Yeah, it's a very good question, but it's quite one of the most difficult questions to answer, because the situation is just so fluid there. You know, Haiti before the earthquake happened was a very difficult environment for the people there. Infrastructure was very poor and poverty levels were very high. The earthquake, of course, has put huge stress on that already very weak infrastructure. So the last figures that I read, I think 1.7 million people were left homeless because of the earthquake. 220,000 people dead. I don't know the numbers on amputees, but I know they're very high. On the other side, the good news is nobody starving there. I mean, food was moved in very quickly. We were able to do that. Some of it because of the geographical location of Haiti. It's quite close to the US, so we're able to move cargo in quite quickly. So fortunately, food did not become an issue. So rebuilding infrastructure now is going to be a big issue. Finding out, first of all, which houses are habitable and which ones need to be destroyed, getting permission to destroy them because people own them, and they have this, naturally, you don't want your home to be destroyed. So it's that part of it, I think, is complicated. We're not involved in it, but I can see the complications of it.
Mm. What about the way you're able to get the food to the people in the camps? And how many? Were you able to see some of these camps for yourself?
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the things that you first see when you go into Port-au-Prince. It looks like a city of tents. I mean, there are tents everywhere. Huge camps, small camps. There are people, and it affected everybody. You know, there are still some of my colleagues and people I met whose houses were okay, but they refused to sleep in them still just because they were so traumatized by what had happened. And some of the camps, I think, were just set up straight after the earthquake, so they didn't have a lot of infrastructure, which means they don't have sanitation, they aren't properly designed. And when I was there, they were really moving camps out of the center of the city, moving them into specialized areas and building them properly. So amenities like football pitches for kids and stuff like that, which you need to have, or plus running water, sanitation. Mm. So, and that again is, that's not done overnight. I mean, I can say quite fairly, to move food into a country is quite a simple process. Reconstruction is much more complicated.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the sanitation, you know, it's going to take a while to get that implemented, and especially if they're moving these camps outside of Port-au-Prince, they're going to have to start from scratch, I would imagine. So and what are hygienic conditions like there for the people?
I thought when I arrived that it wasn't too bad. And then the more I stayed and the longer I saw, and you're able to spot things, it just seemed to be worse and worse. So sanitary conditions, I think, in Port-au-Prince are pretty bad. I think they were pretty bad before the earthquake, and they're worse now. So, and that's difficult, you know. That becomes, again, it's outside my area of expertise, but it's complicated, and it takes time to do it. And these camps, you can't just set up a camp with just running water. You need to have proper sanitation, because everyone was concerned about disease spreading, which fortunately has not been the case up to now, but you need to plan for those things.
Did you get a feel for the commitment by foreign nations, by organizations. Are they sending engineers and people to Haiti to try to figure out which buildings are unstable, which need to be demolished, as you were saying before, and to put some of this infrastructure into place, especially the water?
Yeah. I mean, I felt that there was that presence there, and there certainly was the wish by many, many governments to support Haiti. And I felt that very, very strongly. It was really the first time that I'd worked very closely with the military, especially the US military. And the work that they did was quite admirable. And it was great to see the way that with the change in the presidency in America, how the US military could suddenly be used to provide such a support for Haiti in a very traumatic time. So they came in with huge amounts of equipment. They cleared roads. They got the port up and working. They did a lot of work. So you felt that, you know, they have not only the US military, but a lot of other military. They also have their civil military part of things, which is directly made for this, you know, rebuilding roads, rebuilding bridges. So there is a lot of support on that.
And that's still ongoing to a large extent?
Yeah, the military never like to go in for a long time because their presence can be misunderstood by people. So they always like to have a very quick exit strategy. So they like to fix things up very quickly in a temporary way, and then they like to pull out and move and it moves over to a more civilian operation, which is happening.
What's going on with the airport now?
The airport's functioning. I think they've never had so many flights. When I was there, there were something like 180 flights a day. And we were working in the airport, actually, because they have this humanitarian base there. So it was very, very busy. I mean, obviously not so much commercial traffic, but a huge amount of aid coming in through the airport.
Mm-hmm. What about children and women there? I mean, I get the feeling that they probably are the worst affected by the aftermath of that quake.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. I mean, it was still lovely to see, you know, the nice things you saw on the street was the schools had just reopened when I was there. So they've been closed for 3 months, you know, which obviously isn't the best thing in the world for children. But seeing them going to school and how well turned out they were. I mean, they were impeccably dressed, little ribbons in their hair. And it's really lovely to see. But on the other side, I mean, the schools, a lot of them had been badly damaged. They were having their lessons under tents outside. The rainy season is starting now. For me, looking at a medium term, you'd be really concerned about education standards in Haiti. And it's the only way forward when you really look at it. And fundamentally is that if your population isn't well educated, then, you know, what is the future?
Sure. And what about the women? Were there security issues? Are there security issues for the safety of women and children?
I thought that one of them, just after the earthquake, it was a major concern about security in Port-au-Prince. There were security concerns before the earthquake. There's high levels of violence and gun ownership. And much to everyone's surprise, and it was very welcome, security didn't turn out to be an issue at all. So we still have quite few incidents. So it's not as bad, even though the jail, I think, was badly affected and they had a lot of prisoners who escaped. Up until I was there, security was quite stable. You know, there was a lot of more concern about it, but it was okay. So I didn't feel that there was a lot of gun crime or violence on the streets. There was one or two areas which are known for it, but outside that, it seemed to be okay.
Mm. And are families very supportive of each other there?
Oh, yeah, hugely. Oh, hugely, yeah. And it was also one of the difficulties that we had was because a lot of families left Port-au-Prince and they moved into their, let's say, outer families in different areas of the country. And we suddenly had to gear up towards supporting them with food in those areas. And some of those areas are very remote. And also it brings back to the central idea of the government in Haiti is to decentralize Port-au-Prince. I mean, it had 3 million people out of a population of 15 million. So it's got all the drawbacks of a developing country, large city. So that, you know, with sanitation, with the road structure, with all those things. So they're really looking at decentralizing the capital. So moving some of the ministries away into the provinces.
So how are you getting the food to these more remote areas where many of the population of Port-au-Prince have fled to?
Mainly by road. At the start of the operation, we're doing a lot of helicopters as well, but it's not very cost-effective. They're very expensive. And actually, we found out that they were causing the vibrations from the helicopters were causing problems to the to some of the damaged buildings in Port-au-Prince. Hmm. So we had to move quickly away from that. The roads we were able to use. And then now we're very concerned about the rainy season, which has really already started, and the hurricane season, which starts as the 1st of June.
And Haiti in the past has had some major problems with flooding, with these heavy rains.
Right.
And so what I would assume that the worst affected are going to be the people who are in the camps.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. I mean, we've set up contingency plans for it. So my job really when I was there was to set up a small coastal service. So if the roads deteriorate, which we expect with the rains, and they've been damaged by the earthquake itself, then we have a small vessel which can go up and down the coast. Unfortunately, Haiti has a very extensive coast, so we can reach most of the areas via this service. So we have set up quite comprehensive contingency plans.
Of course, in the beginning, we were talking about Haiti having dropped off the radar screens. What is it going to take to put Haiti back on the radar?
In my job, I prefer it's off the radar because it means that things are quite stable and that you're able to get on with your work. I mean, it will come back in onto the radar if something goes wrong. And that's really not what I want to see. So if you want to maintain donor interest and public interest, you have to get a balancing act between you certainly don't want any tragedy there, but you want still people to be aware. So, I mean, in some way, people want to see some progress. They don't just want to see the continued inertia. They need to see progress, and I can understand that. But progress is slow, and that's what people have to understand. That's quite difficult.
Now, anyone listening to this program, is there anything that they can do in their little way to help?
I had the same question for my family, and I was thinking about it quite a lot. I mean, people tend to think, you know, what can I give physically? Can I give some clothes or some tins of food or whatever? And from what I've seen in a couple of operations, especially in Indonesia as well, after the tsunami, was that the best way to give is just money, because money is easily to transfer. You can buy things locally. You can inject money back into the economy in Haiti, which needs it. And if you give food or clothes, then they have to be transported. They mightn't be what people want. So, yeah, if you're going to give anything, give money. Try and find, there's lots of small, tiny little orphanages and charities there working with local people who are doing great jobs. Try and support those.
And a very warm thanks there to the World Food Programme's Stephen Cahill. And of course, a lot of Catholic aid organizations are on the ground helping the people in Haiti as we speak. To find a list of them and ways to support their programs in Haiti, check out the website of Caritas Internationalis. That's at Caritas, Caritas.org.
111 presos indefesos, mas presos são quase todos pretos, ou quase pretos, ou quase brancos, quase pretos de tão pobres. E pobres são como podres, e todos sabem.
They've been fleeing their homeland for more than 7 years now, seeking peace and a place to start over. Millions of Iraqi Christians and Muslims have streamed across the borders into neighboring countries like Syria and Jordan, trying to put the bloodshed, kidnappings, and heartaches of the conflict in their country behind them. The UN's refugee agency, UNHCR, is estimating that 25,000 to 50,000 Iraqi refugees are currently present in Lebanon. But Isabel Sade, coordinator of the Caritas Migrant Center in Beirut, says those numbers are steadily climbing. She says some 20 to 25 new families are arriving in the country each month, but find themselves in legislative limbo with no visas and no rights.
As for Caritas Migrant Center, we have around 10,000 Iraqi refugees who are being followed by the team of Caritas.
As far as the people that you are personally helping there with Caritas, where are they located? Where are they living?
They are spread all over the country because they are urban refugees. But, for example, we can see in the south of Lebanon and in the north and as well as in the Bekaa. And in Beirut, and they are in specific areas, for example, the Christian among the Christian community and the Muslim among the Muslim community.
And you are cooperating with the UNHCR, with the United Nations Refugee Services?
We are one of UNHCR partners. All these families coming recently, they are the most poor people, if we can say. They waited until now to leave because they did not have the money to pay the airplane ticket or to leave their country. And these people, they have lots of trauma problems, they have a lot of medical problems, and they need to be assisted. And one of the major challenges is the legal status, because Lebanon did not sign the Geneva Convention, so does not recognize the status of refugees. So once they arrive to Lebanon, if they come legally through the airport, they get a visa for 1, 2 to 3 months renewable, but later on they become illegal. And this is the most big challenge for them and for us as an NGO.
So what are you doing to try to change this situation?
We have been trying to lobby with the Lebanese government. So last year in 2009, we were able to get an amnesty. And the refugees who were illegal, they had the chance to find a sponsor and to get a work permit and a residence permit for 1 year. Now, for 2010, we were not yet able to get this amnesty yet, but we are hoping that we will have it soon.
Are most of these Iraqi refugees hoping one day to return to their homes?
Unfortunately, no. The majority wish to be resettled in a third country.
So they don't want to stay in Lebanon?
No, for them, Lebanon is a transit country.
I know that the situation of the Palestinian refugees in Lebanon has always been a topic of heated debate. Palestinian refugees from the 1948 war with Israel there's some 300,000-400,000 of them living in Lebanon now in camps. Palestinian refugees are denied the possibility to work, to have access to social services in Lebanon. We're seeing the same sort of situation there with the Iraqi refugees. Is this a combined problem?
Yes, it's more or less also affecting the Iraqi refugees. They are working, but they are working as daily labor. So people who have some diplomas cannot work as lawyers, as doctors, or even as nurses. So it's a bit challenging.
And what about schools and health services for the refugees?
Refugees, they have access to public schools like any Lebanese and private schools as well, but private schools are expensive. Now, for the medical, they have also access to public hospitals like any Lebanese. So even Lebanese, when they are using the public services, they have to pay. So refugees, they are treated the same. But as Caritas, we are assisting, for example, on the medical level. We are providing 100% coverage for all chronic medication, up to 85% coverage for non-chronic medication and inpatient medical care. We are also providing education assistance for the children. This year, as an example, as Caritas alone, we have assisted 1,375 children to be enrolled in schools, public and private schools.
That's very admirable. You must have met a lot of these people and talked to them and heard their stories. What are some of the stories that have moved you the most?
When we have children who have experienced the kidnap and they are still living the trauma. When we have women, widowed, who came alone with her children without knowing anything about their husband, if he is still alive or not. So these are really very hard stories to hear on a daily basis.
It must be so traumatic for these people as well. You talked there about children being kidnapped themselves or having family members kidnapped. What kind of psychological assistance are you able to offer these refugees who have gone such dramatic trauma?
We have been providing psychosocial follow-up. We have 2 full-time psychologists. Although the assistance provided by a psychologist is still a taboo for some families and maybe sometimes in the Arab world, so it's not easy even to outreach these refugees. But now things are improving because we have the social workers who do regular follow-up, daily follow-up, and even home visits to build the trust between the family and the social worker. So we have our psychologists who conduct individual follow-up, but also sometimes group or therapy or even family therapy for several families who have experienced the same trauma.
Now, you said a lot of these refugees would like to go to a third country and restart a life for themselves. Have you been able to facilitate that for any of these families?
In fact, it's not Caritas' role, but it's UNHCR. And for 2009, we know that there were 2,000 people from Lebanon, more or less, were resettled from Lebanon to a third country. The majority went to the U.S.
Okay, and so you've, together with UNHCR, have been working with the U.S. authorities to facilitate the visa situation for many of these refugees.
Yes.
What about some of the European countries or other countries in the region?
We have some families who went to other European countries, but the big bulk is being sent to the USA. European countries, they don't have big quotas for Iraqi refugees.
Now, Lebanon is a very open, almost a Western society. You have many, many Christians in Lebanon, as well as Muslims. How have the Christian and the Muslim Iraqis who are flooding into the country, how have they been received by the local population?
In fact, they are welcomed. As I mentioned previously, they are living in areas where, for example, Christians are living where Christian Lebanese are, and Muslim the same. And we have, among the Muslim community, we have many mixed marriage, Iraqi men married to Lebanese women.
And
they have been assisted and supported by the local community.
And as we've seen in the Palestinian refugee camps, they basically are living in little neighborhoods all together. Where are you able to find housing for the Iraqi refugees?
They are living in urban areas and in poor areas, if we can say. So, and they are paying for small rooms, expensive rent. First, because they don't have the legal status, so they try as much as they can to hide. Also, in poor areas, maybe they can be supported also. As Caritas, we have field offices all over Lebanon, and even in the areas where the majority of Iraqis are settled.
What happens if an Iraqi refugee who has not obtained legal status yet in the country is caught by the security forces?
He may be arrested. That's why we have noticed that many women are working while men are at home, because they have more risk of being arrested. But once they are arrested, Caritas, they have a presence even inside detention, and we try to lobby with it. Government not to be deported, and we inform directly also UNHCR to check if there's a way to find quickly a resettlement country, so to avoid deportation.
How is Caritas cooperating with some of the Islamic Muslim charities?
In fact, all NGOs working with Iraqi refugees, they are coordinating with UNHCR, so everyone is attending UNHCR coordination meeting, and we are sharing lists together to avoid duplication. And because Caritas is also present in Muslim areas, we are also collaborating with Muslim NGOs working with the Iraqi refugees, and things are going very good on this way.
Isabel Sade is coordinator of the Caritas Migrant Center in Beirut. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.